Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. This episode is the second of our daily reports from the 4th International Paleontological Congress here in Mendoza, Argentina, and we've got quite a mixed bag of interviews for you today. Now, I say daily reports, but we've actually got the day off tomorrow. It's a scheduled break mid-conference for the delegates to go on their short field trips, visit some vineyards in the surrounding countrysides, or even go to the spa. It's a welcome break for most, but not for me. We've had two interview requests from you guys on Facebook, and let's just say that I've organised one of them and it will blow your minds. So I'll be desperately revising all day tomorrow in the hope that I won't embarrass myself, and hopefully that's not giving away who it's with. There's still time for me to arrange more interviews, so if there's anything you want to hear about, just leave us a message on our Facebook group or tweet us, but you'd better be quick about it. As always, please leave us a comment and share us with anyone who you think might be interested. You know the deal. And we hope you enjoy today's coverage. So Alana Sharp of Monash University has got a poster on sinuses and brain size in marsupial megafauna. So could you tell us about your work, please?
Right, so this poster outlines the increase in sinus volume versus brain volume as an animal gets larger. So in very, very large megafauna, like Diprotodon, which is roughly the size of a modern rhinoceros.
That looks a bit like a wombat.
They are. They're related to wombats.
So they're just giant rhino-sized wombats.
Exactly.
Right, yep. Okay.
Big, hairy, rhinoceros-sized wombats. So essentially, as the animals get bigger, they get much, much larger sinuses, which are air-filled cavities within the skull, and much smaller brains compared to smaller marsupials.
So what's the advantage of having these big holes in the heads?
Well, if you can imagine a skull that is as long as up to a metre in length, it would be incredibly heavy if it was made of solid bone. So having it filled with air sinuses allows it to be significantly lighter. It also expands the outside of the skull for the attachment of masseter muscles, big muscles to be able to chew, without increasing brain size. So of course the brain is a very metabolically expensive organ, so if you can keep it small, that's beneficial.
So I guess they didn't really need big brains, were they just content having the same size?
They were probably very stupid animals.
But they had strong jaws.
They did, yes. Yeah.
So is there any way of quantifying how these sinuses actually benefit the animal?
Apart from the fact that they significantly lighten the skull, they may also help to distribute stress more evenly over the skull. I have run a biomechanical analysis using finite element analysis, and some preliminary results say that that might be the case. So it's potentially that they could help to reduce the stress and make it more even, and that might actually reduce the likelihood of fatigue failure.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay.
So Heitor Franceschini has got a poster on invertebrate trace fossils on vertebrate coprolites. So Heitor, how do you know that these coprolites have been fed upon by these invertebrates?
Well, here we have some samples of coprolites of Cretaceous of Brazil, and the superior surface of the coprolites have some marks or some traces that we are trying to identify. Until now, we determine that are poop traces, by the way. Is a trace is made by larvae of insects or some kind of arthropods that in the coprolites they poop it means they pass to the next phases of the ontogeny.
Right.
It means is poop traces, is Poopikian behavior.
Okay, so it's like maggots eating the dung of the vertebrates. So what do the traces actually look like? Are they just like little holes or are they grooves?
They are borings, rod-like, long and concave marks, but they are no burrows or tunnels. They are only in the external surface or of the coprolites, but only in the upper surface, not in the lower surface.
And in the modern times, do we see similar behaviours? Do the pupae only eat the outer surface, or do we find some that burrow inside?
And actually, we have dung beetles and dung flies that made the same marks in feces. Well, it's very, very similar to that we found in the coprolites.
So how long has this interaction of invertebrates and vertebrates been going on for? When's the first time that we see arthropods eating the dung of vertebrates?
Well, in the coprolites of invertebrate coprolites is the oldest interaction. It means it's the first interaction between larvae and coprolites. We have only marks of pooping, of poopy behavior in bones and hard grounds. But it's the first occurrence of this behavior in coprolites. Oh, it means Cretaceous.
Brilliant, thank you.
Thank you a lot.
So a man who should need no introduction to our Paleocast following is John Tennant, who's here with a poster on his latest research on dwarf crocodiles. So could you tell us what you were looking at and what you found out?
Yeah, hi Dave. So the group we're looking at are called Otoposaurids, and they're these really poorly known groups of crocodiles from the late Jurassic through to the end of the Cretaceous. And they may be really important in the ascent of modern crocodiles. So despite being really tiny, they have quite a lot of kind of advanced characteristics, which may be very important in the early evolution and ascent of modern crocs. So we're trying to figure out their species level relationships and just see what's going on down in crocodile world.
Okay, so you've been looking at allopatric speciation. Can you tell us what that is?
Okay, yeah, so previous authors had hypothesized that within Germany and France we have these two independent basins, and within each of them there's three crocodile genera, and they're both co-evolving lineages, or triplets of genera almost. And what's previously been suggested is that they actually form part of the same growth lineages and should all be subsumed into one crocodile species. But we analysed that and we found that not only is there phylogenetic information which separates them, but also allometric information. So, there's no actual substantial evidence showing that they should be synonymized into a single genus. So what we actually find is that we have an incredibly high species level diversity separated by little seas back when Europe used to be an island archipelago. And we find it's pretty cool. So sea level was dropping and rising all the time. You probably can't see me doing the hand thing, can they? And, we find it may have actually been driving this really high diversity in crocodiles throughout the late Jurassic. And then maybe these guys even pervaded and continued to evolve in the early Cretaceous. And it's just a nice little story. So
it's that the two groups of crocodiles were pretty geographically close to each other, but they went on their own individual evolutionary pathway.
Yeah, so what you end up with is three genera, each with separate species in the French and German basins. And we find, I know you can't see the image, but it was just published the other day in PeerTrace, so you can read about it there if you want. But we have a big island throughout the centre of France, and that's separating two seaways. So you have a German basin where Archaeopteryx and all those famous specimens are from.
That's the Solnhofen.
Yeah, that's where these guys are from. They're actually much rarer than Archaeopteryx. There's only two of these guys known, and one of them's in a private specimen. And other genre are equally rare, and some of them were unfortunately destroyed during the war. So we only have images to go on, but we're hoping that maybe some new fossils will come out in the future. You know, they're obviously far more rare and important than Archaeopteryx and all that, so hopefully it'll spur a lot of research into these guys. And then the best thing about it is that like these guys are less than a foot long, each one of them, but really tiny. So there's possible evidence for dwarfism as well. So like you see in Madagascar, you find, you know, the predators and things, so they shrink to conserve resources, so it's competitive. Yeah, it's just a nice little story, we think. So.
And what are you going to do next with these guys?
So, got to be very sneaky about this. We have a new specimen in the Isle of Skye, which myself and a couple of colleagues from Scotland are going to be naming shortly. And as well as that, there's been a lot of taxonomic confusion, I think, recently. So this genre, Theriosuchus, has potentially got a duration of about 80 million years from the late Jurassic all the way through to the end Cretaceous. No crocodile, in fact no genus, has that kind of longevity in the fossil record, and this has become like a taxonomic nightmare. So we're going to have to go through and redescribe some of these specimens, and my research here shows that they're probably an independent genre, and you know, we actually have a lot higher diversity throughout the Cretaceous than as previously suggested, we think. So.
Alright, thanks John.
Cheers, mate.
Deserts are probably one of the most inhospitable places on Earth, but still, animals and plants colonize them. And looking at the invasion of the deserts is Veronica Krapovicas from the University of Buenos Aires. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the obstacles that you have to overcome to live in a desert?
Yeah, well, deserts are a really extreme environment when you have like high temperatures, high variation of temperatures, like high temperatures during the day and the nights are cold. So you have to adapt to live like in a changing environment all the time. You have dunes that move with the wind, so nothing is really stable. But so what we were looking for is like to compile a huge database of the data of trace fossils that are in deserts, because actually the trace fossil record is pretty good on deserts, and the bone record is not that, it doesn't have that lack to get preserved in deserts. So what we have seen is like from the Cambrian on, we have the first steps into the deserts. You have animals that mostly live in the, that are inhabitants of the sea, but make short excursions outside the sea. And then mostly in the Devonian, it seems like the inland deserts were colonized first. But mostly we have the record of insects, and no plants, and no tetrapods, of course. So the question is what the insects were feeding on, because there is no plants. But we think it's the organic material that is bring by the wind, that is the food that they could be eating on. And then later, like more in the, mostly in the lowermost Permian, you have the tetrapod record is huge. It's like in the desert of the whole world is full of tetrapods that we guess they were eating on the insects that were eating on the organic material, and you start to get some record of plants. From that on, it started from the Triassic on, you start to see how the insects and also tetrapods get underground. Because it's the best strategy to survive in a such extreme environment that change all the time. So during the day you hide behind the ground when you have like very short changes in temperature and humidity. So during the night that is cold, you can go out, and that seems that it was like mostly resolved during the Mesozoic.
So do you think that the deserts actually have one of the best records of colonization, even though you don't get any body fossils?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very cool record, but it's not the best for sure, because deserts are really are environments that don't get preserved many things. Actually, it's hard to get information about desert, about the life on deserts. But the good thing is, like, the trace fossil records is good compared to body fossils, but it's not good compared to other environments that are much more rich. Deserts are really hard to get data of. But it's a very interesting environment, so why not to try it?
So normally I wouldn't think of looking in sandstones for fossil evidence. Should we actually be looking in there for trace fossils?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, maybe the problem is that people have not been looking on Aeolian sandstone for trace fossils, and maybe the trace fossils are there. You have to get used of the shape of the trace fossils, so you start to see it more often. I'm sure they are there, so it's a matter of starting looking for it. You should definitely.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, a voice that you should all be very familiar with, I've managed to find Laura Sol.
Hello.
Laura, you've had a busy day today.
Yeah, I have.
What have you been doing?
So they very nicely scheduled my poster and my presentation on the same day. So yeah, I had a poster presentation earlier, which was at lunchtime, on one part of my PhD, and then I had I just did an oral presentation. I was actually the chair for the session as well. So I've had a lot on.
So you were presenting your poster, you had to stand by that for an hour, and then immediately after go and take control of an entire session and also speak in said session.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you dreading today?
Yes, very much so. Dave knows that I was dreading today. That's why he's asked that question. It was actually all right. It went better than I thought it would probably. But yeah, I'm glad it's done. And it went okay. So now I can relax, which is nice.
How many steaks or glasses of red wine have you had
so far at the conference?
Yeah.
I've only had one glass of red wine and I have not had any steaks yet. Tonight is the beginning of the steak and wine binge.
Right, sounds good. I think I'll join you. So in an aquatic environment, hydrodynamics is a very important thing. And Tom Fletcher has been looking at scales of sharks. So could you tell us about your research?
Yeah, so I'm working on shark scales in particular. The problem with the fossil record often, as you'll know, is that soft tissues aren't very well preserved. Shark scales are a bit different because they're in contact with the fluid flow. They're actually directly interacting with that fluid flow. So they present a unique opportunity to study the hydrodynamics over the surface of these structures. So I look at the very fine detail, the hydrodynamics of these shark scales. Modern sharks are a fantastically diverse and disparate group, and we can use those as an analogue for the fossil fishes that have the similar morphologies. There is actually a real convergence of form, a common solution to a common problem in the morphology of these scales, and we can look at that back in the fossil record and interpret ecology, but what I'm specifically interested in is drag reduction. Drag reduction is achieved in modern sharks by these things called riblets. Riblets are these peaks and troughs on the surface of the scales, and this has been exploited by the Speedo company for their swimsuits. It's been put on the outside of planes, inside of pipes, the underside of boats. It's a very effective way at reducing what's called skin friction and improving drag reduction. Drag is anything that impedes velocity of fluid moving over the surface. Obviously, if you're living in water, that's a really important thing to do. And it turns out that in the fossil record you have these riblets. You have these riblets at a very, very early stage, in fact. Up to 460 million years ago, in fact, we have evidence for these riblets on the scales. And that was a really interesting proposition to look at fossil fish scales and see if they're doing the same thing as modern sharks. So what I did, I measured lots and lots of modern shark scales and the riblet spacing, and we worked out that the slowest moving sharks have really far apart riblets, and the fastest sharks have quite close together riblets. And this is directly related to the physics as well. To maintain optimum drag reduction, having more finely spaced riblets is better at reducing drag at higher speeds. So it turned out, yes, it nicely worked in the modern sharks. We applied it to fossil fishes, a group of spiny sharks called the Acanthodians, and also a jawless group called the Thelodonts. And it turns out they have these riblets, but they're also very close together as well. They're around the same lines as fast to mediumly fast sharks, moderately fast sharks, I should say. And that's really interesting. We're not saying that these Thelodonts acanthodians are as fast as Mako sharks or anything like that, but we're saying that this novel adaptation for drag reduction was there from the earliest stages of vertebrate evolution. We're really presenting the first evolution of pelagic speed, of open water speed in the fossil record.
Okay, and what are these little scales actually made of? You say that you don't normally get soft body preservation, so how are you getting these scales?
Scales are, in the case of sharks, are basically teeth. They have the same cross-section as teeth, they have dentine, and they have a pulp. But they're just on the outside of the skin. Sharks will shed their teeth, their mouth teeth, throughout their lives, and they also shed their dermal denticles, dermal teeth, if you like, skin teeth, literally. So these things are made of the same thing teeth are. So they're preserved very well in the fossil record, and this nice ornamentation you have on the surface of the scales is often preserved in very nice detail.
So, probably one of the most famous sharks in the fossil record is Megalodon, the giant, massive, big one. Could you work out, well, could you use its scales as a proxy for working out its speed? How fast did it go?
You could do. I don't know that any scales of Megalodon have actually been found. We have great white shark, modern great white shark scales. They're actually in the mid-range. Great white sharks, most of the day, they're not jumping out of water eating seals. Most of their time, they're really slowly migrating. They're very far traveling, but they actually move at quite slow speed. Surprisingly slow speed, in fact. Maybe as low as half a meter a second, which for a big, big animal isn't very fast at all. So the likelihood is Megalodon was doing the same kind of thing. If it had that same ambush predator kind of lifestyle, it doesn't need to move quickly for long distances like things like Mako sharks do. It's unlikely that these things were moving very fast the majority of the time. But it would be certainly cool to see if they did when they were hunting.
All right, Tom, thank you very much.
Cheers, thanks.
So I'm stood in front of a poster now called A Dinosaur Lost at Sea, and it's about a titanosauriform in some marine deposits in Australia, and we've got Stephen Poropat here. Could you tell us how this giant land animal got out into the middle of the sea?
Well, I guess we don't really know the exact answer, but if we look at modern analogues, we could imagine that because this animal would have had, you know, quite a large gut full of bacteria that would have been helping it digest its food, that after this animal died, they would have continued, you know, building up in the muscles and in the gut. Everything expands out, the carcass floats out to sea after it's bloated up, and eventually either bits of it have dropped off. In this case, that seems to be what's happened. You've got the limb that doesn't have any pneumatization, probably heavier than the vertebral column. It's sunk to the bottom of the sea. We don't know if the rest of the carcass was with it, but yeah, that seems to be what's happened.
So it's just an isolated limb then that you've found preserved in some otherwise marine rocks?
Yeah, I mean, it was found back in 1996 on a property near Richmond in Queensland. We went looking for the locality again. We, I think, failed to find it, but nearby we did find, you know, partial ichthyosaur, inoceramid bivalves. So it was definitely a marine unit, the Alaru mudstone. But yeah, as far as we're aware, it's an isolated limb. Other isolated bones found in the marine units include the Cuendon sauropod, which is one vertebra, and also Ostrosaurus itself, which is a series of vertebrae with a couple of ribs.
Is it a pretty common occurrence then to get these sauropods and other dinosaurs washed out into the sea?
Yeah, strangely enough, it is. Because, you know, underneath the Winton Formation, which is dominantly a terrestrial setting, you've got this sequence of marine units that form the Eromanga Sea in their latest early Cretaceous. We do find sauropods fairly commonly in the Alaru mudstone, more commonly than you'd expect, especially because, generally speaking, sauropods are really rare in marine units. We're not entirely sure why. They might not have liked coastal environments and preferred inland environments, but in this case, yeah, our sauropods are found there really relatively often.
So do you find more theropods, was that?
We have not found, we've never found theropods in the marine units, except for a couple of birds, so yeah.
Okay, and do you see, well, when you have big animals, kind of like whales, that die and sink to the bottom, you get this whole whaleful community of scavengers that live off the carcass. Is there any kind of evidence on this big femur that you've got of anything that was kind of burrowing into the surface or trying to eat it?
We don't have the femur. I mean, we've got the radius ulna, metacarpals, and the shoulder girdle. But the great arch humerus is probably a bit confusing. But
you can tell I don't work on vertebrates. Sorry.
Quite all right. We with this particular animal, I honestly don't know if there was anything associated with it, because when I first started working on the specimen in 2012, there was no matrix at all. I can tell you that on Ostrosaurus, we do have evidence of ammonites and Inosurama bivalves, so they were clearly enjoying a meal of sauropod flesh or something after the animal had died. So yeah, they probably would have attracted the attentions of scavengers once they'd sunk to the bottom.
And so this is a new species of titanosaur.
I think it is a new titanosauriform species. It's kind of difficult to place it on the tree, because a lot of the bones that would preserve features that would tell us where it sits, we can't really get them on this specimen. The thing is that a new matrix that's coming out very shortly will be able to more finely place this animal, because it's got more characteristics relating to the forelimb. So. Yeah.
Great, look forward to it. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.